The following views and opinions do not necessarily reflect those of AM 1230 WYTS, its staff, management, or parent company, Clear Channel Broadcasting. Listeners should not use Dr. Kvitko's comments and advice in the place of receiving an actual dental exam.
Brighten your life with a smile that shows the professional touch of Dr. Kvitko.
Time now for Dentally Speaking with Dr. Brian Kvitko on AM 1230 WYTS. Call 821-1230. That's 821-1230 to discuss your dental issues. Now, here's your host, Dr. Kvitko on AM 1230 WYTS.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko. Our show is also known as Everything You've Always Wanted to Know About Dentistry, but we're just too numb to ask. Hello, I'm General Dentist Dr. Brian Kvitko, and thank you for getting up and joining me this morning. It's a great weekend in Columbus. The Buckeyes won, so that's good, and USC lost. That's even better, correct? This morning, in the studio with me on the show is attorney Paul Lafayette. Paul Lafayette is a malpractice attorney. He defends doctors, dentists, and I believe there was one more that I missed.
Lawyers, real estate agents. It's all professional liability defense.
Oh, you defend lawyers?
Yes.
Lawyers get sued?
Oh, yes, we do.
I didn't know that. Let me give a little bit of information about Paul. He works for Reminger Attorneys at Law. Prior to joining them, he completed a judicial clerkship with the Ohio Supreme Court. Since joining Reminger LPA, Paul's practice is concentrated in three areas. We just mentioned those: professional liability, representing lawyers, dentists, and real estate agents; government liability, representing municipal corporations in all areas, including personal injury, employment, and zoning; and thirdly, complex personal injury litigation. Paul practices in all state and federal courts in Ohio at the common pleas, appellate, and Supreme Court levels. He also represents professionals in disciplinary proceedings before licensing boards. And he is a featured speaker at the Ohio State University College of Dentistry on issues such as dental risk management and malpractice. He's also been a featured speaker on general liability risk management, governmental liability, and legal ethics. And that's all well and good, Paul, but I imagine this is the pinnacle of your career is being on this show, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's all been leading up to this.
This is the high water mark of my career, and it will go on that bio very soon.
Okay, good. I want to see that right next to the picture. The only thing missing from this is that he likes long walks on the beach. our number is 821-1230, and those of you that have questions, you have a concern, you've had something happen at your dental office, you're wondering if it should be an instance that you should file a lawsuit, or you're a dentist or a dental student and you want to ask questions of Paul, nice thing about the show here is no one is charging you. So you can get some free advice, good advice, professional advice. Before we get on to that, I do want to give out today's question of the day, and it was provided by Paul, and it is, this is according to the Ohio Department of Insurance, what percent of the time do patients who sue their doctor or dentist wind up receiving no payment of any kind? Now, that is for doctors and dentists, right?
Correct.
Okay, so kind of lumped in together. All right, I don't think they have stats for just dentists, maybe not?
No, I don't think. Well, they may have it, but
we don't.
I wasn't able to come up with that.
Okay, so just so you know, that's not just dentists, that is doctors and dentists thrown together. You can call in with your guesses to the answer of the question, which is 821-1230. You can also email your guesses to dentallyspeaking on am1230@yahoo.com. So, Paul, I just want to start off, first of all, I do appreciate you getting up. It's early on a Sunday, and I know you're a busy guy, and you've got a baseball game. You've got two sons waiting for you to be doing something. So,
right.
Be very dedicated, and I think a lot of our guests are dedicated and passionate about what they do, and with a little bit that we've met, I believe that you're one of them.
So, well, I appreciate that.
Have you seen an increase, an increase in malpractice suits that are being filed against dentists as the economy has worsened?
Well, I don't know necessarily that I've seen an increase that I would relate to the economy. I will say that since probably 2002, 2004, I've certainly seen an increase in the number of suits that are filed against dentists.
Let me ask you this rather than the way I would put it is, do you think that people are suing as a way to get money, as maybe they feel like it's a way to hit the lottery without having to have those long odds and spend money?
Well, generally speaking, when it comes to dental malpractice cases, the odds of hitting the lottery are are pretty slim. The dental malpractice does not lend itself to high jury awards or anything like that. I think that a significant number, I don't know if I would say half, but it's a fairly significant number of the lawsuits are really filed to try to avoid payment. If a patient owes a certain amount of money, they will file suit, once the collection letters come, if they haven't made payments over a long period of time. That is generally what happens, and they will file a small claim suit or a municipal court case. On some occasions, if there is any additional treatment that is required in the future, they'll obtain an attorney and go to common pleas court.
You know, now that you mention that, I think I've actually experienced that. It seems like everything is fine till the bill arrives, and then all of a sudden they don't like the color, right?
Yeah, that happens frequently. If you're, a lot of times there will be problems that will be brought up by the patient when the bill arrives, or after they receive a couple letters saying, dear patient so-and-so, you have not paid us, and we've been waiting on payment patiently for the last 6 to 9 months. Then all of a sudden you'll get the letter back saying that I'm unhappy with this, or it doesn't feel right, or it doesn't look right. And then at that point, that's their attempt. And in a lot of my experiences, I'm not saying this is for everyone, but certainly that's the time when the patient is attempting that initial pushback, saying, I really don't want to pay this bill.
Now, does the patient have some kind of an obligation to let the dentist know before this bill comes that they're unhappy? I mean, it seems so obvious if you wait 6 months and you've been getting bills and collection letters, and then all of a sudden you don't like it. So what do the people say? Well, I didn't like it from day one, but I didn't want to bother the person, or I was too embarrassed to complain. I mean, how do they explain that away?
Well, I think in my experience, in the cases that I've seen that arise out of the situation, it's fairly easy. Let's put it this way. If I were presenting the case to a jury or to a judge even, it would be presented that, the patient waited 9 months or a year, and we can show the letters when the collection letters began, and then all of a sudden when the complaints arose was ironically, or coincidentally, I should say, at the same time.
Okay.
But back to your first question, talking about whether patients have a duty or an obligation to advise the doctor of problems with their treatment or any things that they're unsatisfied with. Generally speaking, I don't think that there's no rule that says that, but certainly if the patient truly feels that they're unhappy with the treatment, or if there's a problem with the treatment, they do have an obligation to go back to the doctor to have an opportunity, to give the doctor an opportunity to identify what the problem is and fix it. There are situations that often arise where, dentistry is not an exact science. It's another branch of medicine, and not everything is going to come out at the end of a treatment exactly the way the patient wants it, or even the doctor wants it.
Right.
But the doctor is not clairvoyant. He doesn't have a crystal ball in his office saying, patient Smith out there in Upper Arlington isn't happy with their treatment today. Patient Smith needs to pick up the phone or come back in and say, look, I'm really not happy with this.
Because no news doesn't necessarily mean good news. If a person leaves and we don't hear back from them, we assume everything is fine.
Correct. And that's one of the frequent occurrences that I see. And this kind of dovetails into another issue, to the extent that if a patient doesn't call the doctor back and say, I've got a problem, sometimes the patients encounter a problem, and because they encounter a problem, they're surprised by having a problem, and they decide, well, the doctor that did this treatment on me must not have done a good job, so I'm going to go to a different doctor. And a lot of times the new doctor that they go to isn't familiar with the care, doesn't understand the underlying diagnosis or treatment plan, and they may give them the patient a different way to go. And then the patient then assumes that the very first doctor that treated them did something wrong.
Right.
And that happens quite frequently.
Yeah, if you get about 10 doctors or dentists in a room, and you you give them a set of x-rays, a scenario for this patient, maybe make it a fictitious patient, you'll have about 20 different treatment plans.
I absolutely agree. I've witnessed this. I've been doing dental malpractice for quite some time now, doing dental malpractice defense work, that is. And, one of the frequent things that comes up is, we, you know, obviously in part of litigation, we have to obtain an expert. You know, I have to talk to my doctor that I represent, and he advises me what treatment plans he gave to the patient. Then I present the case to an expert, and the expert looks at it and said, well, the doctor could have done this, he could have done this, he could have done this. Mm-hmm. There's three or four different treatment plans. And then on the opposite side, the plaintiff's, you know, the patient's attorney obtains an expert, and that expert has a different opinion. So everybody's got different opinions.
There is more than one way to skin a cat, so to speak.
Absolutely.
And as long as the outcome is a good outcome and the patient is satisfied, then it doesn't matter which of those 20 ways is undertaken.
Right, right.
Now, something that you hit on or you mentioned kind of struck a chord with me, and there seems to be a different standard that people hold dentists to as opposed to physicians. So, for example, back in 1987, unfortunately for me and my family, my father went in for three-way or four-way coronary bypass surgery, and he died. But the doctors told us that the surgery was a success, but the patient died. And doctors, it seems to me, are able to tell that story more often than a dentist. It seems like if I've touched a person's tooth, then somehow I'm responsible for anything that ever happens to that tooth ever again, whether they've ever brushed their teeth since I saw them last or not. Why is that? Why are people holding dentists to this higher standard?
You know, I have a few theories, but I don't know any one particular reason why that occurs, but it is without a doubt something that I've witnessed and experienced in my experience as an attorney. And I will say that when I'm at the university and I'm speaking to the dental students, this is one of the issues that I bring up, that unfortunately, I believe that most of the patients and the public at large view dentistry as more of an exact science. I don't know if it's because of the advertising, you know, the painless dentistry and, you know, come in today for 24-hour dentures. People don't view serious health procedures or medical procedures or something that's going to be taken care of, boom, boom, in the door and out the door in one day, no problems. And so I think perhaps that has something to do with the perception. By example, you know, as an attorney, and this goes to all professions as well, as an attorney, I defend cases in trial. And I can do my very best to prepare the case for trial. I can advise my client that, look, I think that we have a very good chance of winning this case. I think you're absolutely correct. We have an expert that says X and so, and which defends our case. But ultimately, at the end of the day, there are eight people that are going to be sitting in a jury box that are going to make that decision on whether we win or lose the case. At the conclusion of a trial, despite, you know, my beliefs that we're going to win a case, if a jury goes against us, generally speaking, there's no lawsuit. I mean, I've never been sued for malpractice, and, you know, I'm not going to say that I've won every single case I've ever tried. So there's an understanding. And as in your father's case, you know, triple bypass surgery, you know, we know and understand the gravity and the seriousness of the procedure in that not everything always goes right. However, that doesn't appear, you know, based on my experience, doesn't appear to lend itself to dentistry. Dentistry, patients expect that if you're going to do a root canal, the root canal is going to be successful and that tooth is going to be fine. And that, I think, goes back into an issue that, you know, we'll probably discuss here in a little while as far as informed consent. I think part of that has to be, part of it is the responsibility of the dentist to make sure that the patients understand that this is not an exact science and that there is informed consent relating to the procedure, and that, you know, on the other hand, patients also have to listen.
Well, let's go ahead and do a little bit of it now. For example, I guess what you're saying is, as a dentist, I need to under-promise and over-deliver. I need to lower their expectations so that anything beyond losing this tooth is going to be a win.
Well, I don't know that I would go that. I don't think I would ever advise a client to put it that way, or I certainly wouldn't put it that way. The way I would, let's stick to the law of it.
Okay.
In Ohio, informed consent requires that a dentist or a physician advise the patient of all the risks, of all the substantial risks of a procedure, of all the most common risks and the most serious risks of a procedure, and also discuss with the patient alternatives to particular procedures and those risks and benefits. And the patient, conversely, has to listen and has to acknowledge. And that's when the patient signs a consent form. It means that, doctor, you've explained all this to me, and by signing it, I understand what you've advised me. Now, you don't have to, a doctor is not required to create a laundry list of everything that could possibly go wrong with a procedure. But you do have to address the most serious or the most common risks. And
if I were to say, okay, Paul, you're my patient, you come in and you have an abscess, and if I were to say, we need to do a root canal in tooth number 19, and among other things, probably the worst thing that could happen is we won't be able to get around this curved root, won't be able to seal it properly, and you might lose this tooth.
And that's absolutely correct. Okay. And there are some circumstances where you could say, you know, despite our efforts, the root canal may be done. We may perform the root canal fine. We may seal the canal perfectly. But the antibiotics or other other therapeutic treatment that we give for the abscess may not be successful, and we may ultimately need to extract the tooth.
Well, and I have... And, you know, I have this series of x-rays that I've saved from various patients that have come into my office showing all of these different root canals that don't look like they live up to the standards that we think of when a root canal is done. It's not what we were taught to do, for example. Teeth where the roots are only sealed halfway down, where only one out of the three roots were sealed, where they forgot to do the root canal, and but yet move forward with the crown. And in every one of these instances, the tooth is perfectly happy. It's perfectly fine, not hurting the patient, serving just fine. So just because a root canal wasn't sealed like a textbook photograph of what a root canal should look like doesn't even mean that's the reason it's going to fail.
Correct. You know, in my experience, certainly in administrative procedures with the dental board, for instance, you know, generally, the way the administrative investigative process goes, they will review primarily charts, and they'll look at those x-rays. They'll have no idea or understanding necessarily of the success of the treatment or whether the patient had any problems after the root canal, but they will certainly look at the x-rays and say, well, I'm looking at the roots of this tooth, and it looks like the filling of this canal was 4 millimeters short of the apex, meaning that there was not a complete fill. Or there are instances where there's an overfill.
Correct.
And at the end of the day, that may occur, but just because that didn't meet the textbook standard of what you would want as a dentist or as a clinician does not mean that something happened and went wrong.
Right.
In 90% of these cases, there was never, ever another problem with the tooth. The patient is entirely happy. The crown is successful, and they've been wearing it for 10 years.
Right, right. I have one of those files dates back to 1977, so that's 22 years ago somebody did this procedure, and I have no idea why the tooth is fine, because I'm sure if I had touched it or gotten within 3 feet of it, it probably wouldn't be now, you know?
Well, and one of the risks is, you know, if it goes back to the old axiom there, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, something like that, you don't want to go back in there, because running a greater risk to the patient that the problem will now arise.
That's exactly the case, and I haven't touched any of those, because I can see clearly that on the x-ray they look fine, the patient has no symptoms, and as far as I'm concerned, it's a successful treatment, even though... Again, if I had done it, I'm sure it would have failed. Or they'd be having problems. We need to go to a break here. So I don't want to get bogged down completely on root canals, but when we come back, I do want to tell my audience a little story about a root canal that I am familiar with. You are listening to Dentally Speaking here on AM 1230 WYTS, and we will be right back.
Smiling when you're smiling.
Welcome back to Dentally Speaking with Dr. Kvitko. Good morning. Today in the studio as my guest is Paul Lafayette. Paul Lafayette is a malpractice defense attorney, which means he defends doctors, dentists, real estate agents. He has also worked with governmental liability, representing municipal corporations, which I guess are cities.
Townships, cities.
This I found interesting. Paul practices in all state and federal courts in Ohio at the common pleas, appellate, and Supreme Court level. That's like big time. That's like the NFL as opposed to high school, isn't it?
Well, you almost have to. There's no other, you know, you have to be able to follow cases all the way up to the Supreme Court. And from the federal side, probably just recently, I've got my license in U.S. Supreme Court because of a case that was filed. So,
oh, wow.
You know, it only took a decade to get that far.
And so that'll do you for a while now. Once you have that,
right.
One, you're good. Okay, before we get back to our conversation about suits and outcomes and all that, I do want to mention that we have a new RSS feed for our iTunes And so if you've already subscribed to our podcasts via iTunes, you need to resubscribe because you'll find that it's not been updating. And the reason is it's a whole new feed. My IT person changed servers or something that's beyond my knowledge of computers. So anyway, just go in and resubscribe. It's free, but if you want to get the want it to update weekly as the shows come on board, you'll need to do that. Also, I did want to mention that when we went to the Buddy Walk, you might remember that we had been preparing for the Down Syndrome Association of Central Ohio's Buddy Walk, and they were able to raise $170,000 at the Buddy Walk, so congratulations to them. Our small donation through Libby's Tooth Buds seemed small compared to that, but I guess it all adds up. So before the break, we were talking about outcomes and how I have several samples of root canals done elsewhere that are fine, even though if I had done that, if I had looked at my final x-ray, I'd have said, I can't leave it like this. This is never going to work. Tom, I need you to come back the next day and let me see if I can get a little further. Now, I did not go in and redo anything, but you also mentioned something about these doctors or that, yeah, like a plaintiff will get an expert, they'll look at x-rays and they'll say da-da-da, right? Well, I have a case where this woman developed this huge abscess around a molar. I mean, the abscess was bigger than the tooth root, you know, just kind of almost got into the other two teeth. And I did a root canal, and after a certain number of weeks, probably about 6 months, all that affected bone filled in, except for an area about the size of a normal abscess. And I know that if she goes to another office and they look at that x-ray, they're going to tell her she has a new abscess around an old root canal, because they don't have the pre-op x-ray. They didn't see what it used to look like. And there is such a thing as bone scarring, where the periosteum is affected, and you will never get complete healing as far as an x-ray vision of the bone. So when I see a person who has a root canal, who has what appears to be a secondary abscess, I always, always ask them to track down the old x-ray. I want to see what it looked like the day the root canal was done. If it looks smaller, if it looks healthier, if it's definitely healed, and no pain, as far as I'm concerned, it's a success. If, on the other hand, the abscess, as it looks on an x-ray, is bigger now than it was 2, 3, 4 years ago when they had the root canal done, I know I have a problem. And so, you run into this, don't you, where judgment calls are made. You go to another dentist, and they say, oh, you need your root canal redone.
Well, I will say that happens probably most frequently, and in my experience looking at the particular cases that get filed, I would say a vast majority of the cases involve second-guessing someone's initial treatment. And going back to your earlier, what you just said a few moments ago, one of the most important things that I think patients should understand, and I think everybody should, you know, take this into account, you know, at the end of the day, what everyone is trying to do is provide good dental treatment and to get a patient back into health, into dental health. And the best way to do that is if you encounter a problem, if you feel you're having a problem, you go back to your dentist and say, I'm having a problem. Because your dentist is going to say, you know what, that's not something I want either. And so what we're going to do is we're going to try to find out and solve the problem. Too often, what will happen is, again, and I think it has something to do with the expectations that, for whatever reason, dental treatment is going to be 100% guaranteed.
Like changing a starter on a car.
Exactly, yeah.
Two bolts, put the new one on, the car's supposed to start.
Right. You know, you did my alignment of my tires, and now I'm getting some wearing on the outside edge, and now you must have done something wrong. So, you know, unfortunately, that is the perception of dentistry, in my view. But what will happen is a patient will have something they're not happy with. They'll go to another dentist, and the other dentist, as does everybody, have differing opinions on treatment plans. And as you said, there's more than one way to skin a cat. And when a patient goes to another dentist and hears, oh, well, I would have done this, or you should have done this, or he should have done this, in reference to the original dentist, what the patient hears is, now I got to pay for this all over again.
Yes.
And that's where the problems arise. If you see, you know, let's say you performed a root canal on a tooth and you gave the patient the proper informed consent. This root canal can be successful, and we're going to crown it, and it'll last for, you know, 10 years or whatever. It'll last for a long time. You should be fine. However, there's a risk it could fail. The patient hears that, and then let's say there's an abscess or some kind of infection that causes them to have greater problems with that tooth even after the root canal is done. And even if the root canal is done properly, they then go to their own, they go to another dentist, and the other dentist says, well, you know, I don't think that the root canal was going to help this tooth. I think you were going to have an extraction one way or the other, so we're just going to take it out. In that patient's mind, they're now thinking,
I want my money back for the root canal.
Exactly.
And the crown.
Exactly. And that's when you get the threatening letter, and that's when you don't get your payment, and that's when sometimes you end up in a lawsuit. And then what will happen in the lawsuit is that despite the risk that the root canal was not going to be successful, it will be then characterized as you did something wrong during the root canal that caused the tooth to have to be extracted.
Oh, of course. I probably was talking on the phone. I don't know. You know, there's all kinds of things that they can surmise.
Right. But the end of that story is, though, that the patient needs to go back to the original dentist. Always right. Give the dentist that you're treating with or who provided your treatment, give them the opportunity to make sure that you're a happy patient, that your treatment is successful. Don't start running around to different dentists because you're going to get these different opinions. And because there are different opinions doesn't mean the original treatment was wrong.
That's a good point, because when people say, I want to get a second opinion, I'll say, that's a good idea, but here's an even better one. Get a third opinion. Because if you have one person says yes, one person says no, then what happens? The patient believes whoever they wanted to believe in the first place. If you get a third opinion, now you have two no's and a yes, or two yeses and a no. Now you're getting somewhere. Am I right?
Right, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, and like you said, if you fill the room with 10 dentists, you're going to get 20 opinions.
Right.
And certainly, if nothing more, the patient is going to have an understanding that, you know, there is more than one treatment modality that was available. And that just by going with Dr. Kvitko versus going with Dr. Smith, whoever Dr. Smith may be, doesn't mean that they did something wrong.
Yeah. We're going to pick this up after the break. We have to go to a commercial. Our number is 821-1230. You're listening to Dentally Speaking here on AM 1230 WYTS, and we'll be right back.
Make you smile, please stay for a while now. Just take your time wherever you go.
Welcome back to Dentally Speaking. You're listening to Dr. Kvitko and Paul Lafayette. Paul Lafayette is a malpractice attorney. We're talking about the kinds of things that people might find when they decide that there's time for a lawsuit. One of the things that, before I get onto that, we had an emailed guest for a question of the day, and I need to restate that. This is according to the Ohio Department of Insurance. The question is, what percent of the time do patients who sue their doctor or dentist wind up recovering or receiving no payment of any kind? And Glenn called in a guest, or rather emailed, I'm sorry, of 65%. That is low. Thanks so much, though, Glenn. And the other issue, well, not the other issue, let me just, before I forget, I want to let people know these shows, these podcasts are available at www.am1230wyts.com. When you go there, hold your mouse over the on-air button, click on Dr. Kvitko, it takes you to my page, and from there you can get to the podcast page. You can also follow me on Twitter by searching Dr. Kvitko with no period. All right, now we have that out of the way. We were talking about going back. If a patient has a problem, they should go back to the original dentist first because they are more familiar with the pre-op. They are also the only one that knows what was going on inside that tooth. They're the ones that saw with their naked eye, you know, how big these canals were, all that. But going back to the original dentist doesn't necessarily mean you won't be charged. It just means that there's a chance that you won't be charged, right?
Right. I mean, going back to the original dentist means that he's going to have all of that historical knowledge of your treatment plan, of the treatment that he provided, and it gives him an opportunity to look at the tooth or look at the implants or whatever. We keep talking about it, root canals because...
Yeah, you're right. We need to get on to some other things. There's some other bad things happening out there, right?
Exactly. But it gives the dentist an opportunity to look at it, and if he decides that, you know what, I probably could have done something a little bit better here, or perhaps there's something that I didn't see, they will go ahead and do it, and they won't charge you for it. But, you know, there's no guarantee because they may go back in there and say, look, there was nothing wrong with what I did, but I am now seeing something new
right. That
we didn't see before, and you'll have to be charged for it.
It could be a crack in a tooth that wasn't there. It could be the next tooth because there are, I know I have an endodontist friend who told me at least four times a month he runs into patients where two teeth right next to each other both died at the same time and both needed it. Okay, now, why are there so many lawyers willing to sue doctors and dentists?
Well, you know, I wish
the pregnant pause.
The pregnant pause. Well, you know, not being one of those that sues the doctors, I don't know. I guess the easiest thing is, I don't want to ever, in the legal profession, we're all colleagues by and large. I mean, right. Plaintiffs, attorneys, defense attorneys, we're all attorneys. And I don't think that there's any malevolent purpose out there by my colleagues on the opposite side. I think they truly believe that they want to help their clients and help their patients. And I don't think every lawsuit is frivolous either. Even though I'm a defense attorney, I'm not hardened.
Oh, there are mistakes that are made, and there are times when I think that that lawsuits are warranted. Don't get me wrong. It just seems like every time you turn around, and, here's this thing. I have this feeling, whenever I watch the evening news and I see a story about this wonderful surgery, some child from Iraq was flown over here to receive some life-changing surgery. Maybe they were burned or they lost a limb or something. Or you hear about a 12-hour operation to reattach somebody's arm. Or the doctor, the ophthalmologist that I hope to have on this show, who has restored a woman's eyesight after 9 years by using a piece of a tooth and some bone that was attached to it, has restored this woman's eyesight. Pretty neat, huh?
I've never heard of that.
Dr. Perez down at Gainesville University of Florida. And he doesn't know it yet, but he's going to be a guest on this show. So anyway, you know what I think? I think that is really cool. But I bet they're being sued by about 3 or 4 different people as we speak.
Well, probably.
For something else.
Yeah, I mean, medical doctors, by and large, are the bigger targets. I have been fortunate to have encountered a lot of dentists in my experience who have never been sued. Or and unfortunately, I've represented one gentleman who was a fantastic dentist here in Columbus. A lot of respect, very well-respected dentist here in Columbus, oral surgeon, who went, I think, 50 years without ever being sued, and he got sued once. It ultimately got dismissed, but, it happens to everybody.
Right. In dental school, they told us if you haven't been sued, you haven't been practicing long enough.
Right, exactly. if you're not sued, you're not trying.
So, what's the most common reason dentists are sued? What would you say?
I would say the most common is kind of a hybrid of what we were talking about before. The most common reason is that a patient does not understand, or that there's a lack of communication between the dentist and the patient as far as the informed consent. The patient will have this expectation that the procedure is going to be successful. And whether that is a breakdown because the dentist did not emphasize the risks of the procedure, or that the patient wasn't listening.
Yes.
And then you take that to the next step of when they go out for a second opinion, or they're unhappy with the treatment, they go to someone else. And the next dentist down the road says, well, I would have done X and Y or Z, and I would have done something differently. Now the patient is thinking, I have to pay for, I'm basically having to pay for the same procedure again, or I wasted my money on the first procedure.
Now, this happens all the time in medicine. I don't think we got it all. So they go in and they do it again. There's a charge for that, right?
Right.
Okay. So it gets back to that. People seem to have this unrealistic idea of our abilities in dentistry, and I guess, like you're saying, it's our own fault for telling people.
I think a lot of it is the perception. I think it's to some degree, patients out there have an expectation or a belief that dentistry is an exact science. It's like changing a tire, it's like changing your hair color, that it should happen the way you want it. I think a lot of that is, you have to fault dentistry as a whole, organized dentistry as a whole, for not emphasizing that, this is a very serious medical profession, and that health is not something that is an exact science.
Okay.
And making sure the patients understand that.
Okay. We're going to talk a little bit more about informed consent when we come back. You're listening to Dentally Speaking here on AM 1230 WYTS, and we will be right back. Dentally Speaking. I'm here with Paul Lafayette, and he is a malpractice attorney. He defends doctors, lawyers, I guess, dentists, real estate agents, works for cities, and actually practices here in town. Primary offices are in Columbus, right?
Yes.
And it's called Reminger Attorneys at Law.
Yeah.
You guys got started in 1958, and would you like to give out your phone number or email address?
Sure.
Not email, but like website?
Sure. Well, first of all, Reminger is the firm that I work for, and it's a statewide firm, and we also have offices in Kentucky. Our main office is in Cleveland. We also have another principal office here in Columbus. My office number is 614-232-2423. And my email address is plafayette@reminger, which is reminger.com.
Right, so if someone has a question, they're too shy to call and talk on the air or something, they can ask you?
Sure, that's fine.
Okay, and remember, Reminger is one M, because I was going to spell it because I would have put two.
Okay.
All right, so I want to find out, is it a law that a dentist has to have a signed piece of paper by the patient, an informed consent form, that... Are you saying without a piece of paper we can't work on anyone without risk of being sued and losing? It has to be in writing? Everything?
No.
Okay.
Ohio does not require by statute, that is, the law does not require a dentist to have an informed consent document exchanged with the patient. The patient doesn't have to sign anything. Now, the standard of care, that is the standard of the profession, requires that informed consent take place. That the doctor advise the patient of the risks and benefits of the treatment, and that the patient consents to the treatment by acknowledging those risks and proceeding with the treatment.
So if I'm in the room and I say to John Smith, hey, you need an implant, or we can put a bridge here, we can put a partial there, and these are the ramifications of each, these are the cost of each, and I write in the chart that I've gone over that with Mr. Smith, and he begins treatment, that is informed consent, right?
Correct. So long as you have covered, you know, this is a form over substance. Now, as a defense attorney, I'll tell you, I love paper because it shows that the patient actually had it and received the informed consent. They signed it and they acknowledged the treatment plan. But that is not, you know, that's the form. The substance of it is, was there a communication between the doctor and the patient going over the risks, benefits of the procedure and the treatment alternatives? And so long as you document in the chart, you know, now technically you don't even have to document in the chart, but you should, as a proper practice in your profession, you should document that you went over the treatment plans and the patient elected treatment plan one, which
right.
called for whatever all risks, benefits discussed and patient consented.
Now see, I'll write out two or three different treatment plans. Remember I said if you get 10 dentists in a room, you're going to have 20 treatment plans. I've actually done as many as 5 different options for a patient, had them all written out, and then we put X's over the ones they didn't select, and they signed them all so that they know that this was at least presented. And then the one that doesn't have the big X through it, of course, is the one that we do. So, and you're saying that's acceptable?
Yes.
Okay. Now, if you're a patient out there, or you're a listener, and you're thinking that you want to sue your dentist, what should a person expect their legal fees to be? I realize you're on the defense side, but what are people having to spend to bring these suits?
Well, that's difficult to tell you as far as for a patient to bring the lawsuit. And the main reason for that is, you know, from the plaintiff's bar, there are contingency fee agreements or there are hourly rate agreements. Most of the time, they're contingency.
Okay.
And if it is a contingency fee agreement, the patient does have to understand that in most contingency fee agreements, I mean, and this is from my experience because I have represented plaintiffs in the past, that if there is a contingency, one-third goes to the attorney. But then the patient or the plaintiff is responsible for costs associated with the litigation. That is the court filing. That is the cost of a court reporter for a deposition. That is the cost of an expert. Experts can be anywhere from, depending on the type of case. I've seen them as little as $1,500, and I've seen them as much as $15,000 on dental cases, and sometimes more, frankly. In medical cases, it gets much more. And ultimately, at the end of the day, the patient is responsible for that. That expense at the end of the litigation, and that's assuming that they succeed.
Wow.
So it can be costly.
So are you saying, that's just for the expert. Okay, so I'm thinking a person could easily spend $30,000 to $50,000 to sue a dentist?
Maybe not that much to sue a dentist. I would say, if I were to give an average, I would say the average dental case, as far as the cost is concerned,
yes.
What the cost that the plaintiff or the patient would be responsible for.
Let's say they lose. Okay. So
if they lose, they'd be out of pocket, let's say, on average, let's say $3,500 up to $5,000 for their expert. Maybe a little bit more, frankly, if the expert testifies live at trial, it could be like $6,000 or $7,000. Then
okay.
They're going to have to pay for depositions. The transcripts and the court filing. I could say in a very average dental case, the patient or the plaintiff could be responsible at the end of the litigation for about $10,000.
Wow.
And that could be, there's a lot of give and take because there's so many different scenarios and so many different experts. that, you know...
When we come back, I want to find out from you what the average award actually really is compared to this $10,000 cost. So, you're listening to Dentally Speaking here on AM 1230 WYTS. It's a beautiful Sunday morning. Thanks for being up with us and listening. We'll be right back. Generally speaking, thanks for joining us this morning. I think we've had a very informative show. Paul Lafayette is on the show. He is a malpractice attorney, and he's has some great insight. What I'm quickly realizing is that there's so much that we haven't talked about. We haven't even scratched the surface. Paul, I wanted to find out if you'd be willing to take some time out of your day on another Sunday and come out and continue this.
Sure, it'd be my pleasure.
Okay, that'd be great. We'll talk off the air about dates and whatnot. And because time is short, I do want to get a couple of things out. First of all, the answer to the question of the day is 80%. So 80% of people who sue their doctor or dentist wind up receiving no payment of any kind. We just talked about how a person could incur approximately up to $10,000 in expenses for suing a dentist, which I assume is less than suing a physician, right?
Correct.
And then what is the most common dollar amount, or the average, I guess, dollar amount that somebody might win if they sue a dentist?
You know, I really don't have a good answer for that.
No, I put you on the spot?
Yeah, you did.
Okay, I'm sorry. No, I didn't mean to.
Well, I'll tell you this much. Most, going back to that statistic that we just threw out there, that was from a 2007 Department of Insurance study regarding professional malpractice suits against physicians, dentists, chiropractors. 80% of the cases that are filed do not 80% of the cases that are filed do not end in any payment to the patient. That includes settlement.
That includes the attorney too. Right.
And there's no and there's no settlement, and there's no award in that end. I will tell you that it is really hard to tell because there's so many different variables in every case. I've handled everything from wrongful death cases to cases where the wrong tooth was extracted.
Yes.
And certainly there's a wide gap between what the value of those cases are and what juries are willing to award. I think suffice it to say is that in any given case where just because there may have been negligence, in the law there are two different things. There's negligence, which is the liability portion, then there's damages.
Okay.
Just because there's negligence does not mean the case is worth $1 million.
Right.
And so there have to be reasonable expectations on what the actual damages are. What was the cost of the subsequent treatment, and how much pain, suffering, or interference in your life was there as a result of that. And I think for the by and large, juries are fairly reasonable. There are some outlier decisions that come out from verdicts that come out where they're really wacky. You hear about the $30 million awards. But by and large, I think juries...
And those are usually lessened substantially on appeal, correct?
Sometimes.
Sometimes
not.
Oh, okay.
Depends where you are.
Okay. So what responsibilities then do patients have with regard to their own treatment, and how does this play into a potential lawsuit?
Well, following up on the informed consent...
This will probably be our last... might have to go to the end of the show, so just talk until the music goes.
going back to the informed consent issue, part of the informed consent is also not only to advise the patient of the risks, benefits, alternatives to treatment, but also to advise the patient that, look, you are going to have some responsibility in this. And patients cannot assume that because a dental implant has been placed in their mouth that they never have to floss or brush that tooth again.
Right.
There is going to be bone loss. It could be bone loss, infection, things of that nature. And the same things that attack our natural teeth are going to attack the bone around the implant. So it is absolutely critical for patients to maintain their own home care, to do their flossing, to do what the dentist asks you to do. And if you don't do that and you end up suing the doctor, is a thing we call comparative negligence, where the jury is going to say, okay, the doctor maybe could have done this treatment maybe a little bit better, but we're looking at what the patient did, and the patient basically caused their own damages because it appears that they never followed up on their own care.
And that means going to the dentist as well for regular cleanings, exams, x-rays, and giving a dentist a chance to catch it and maybe see that there's a little bit of peri-implantitis, which is a new term because we've created a new entity.
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. So, patients, you do have a responsibility. Remember that. You can't just have a treatment and then, just disappear and never brush and never return. Just like a car, you have to maintain it. So, hey, thanks so much for tuning in. We will have Paul back on the show at some point down the line. And there's so much more I want to cover, and hopefully you guys will find interesting. So tune in next Sunday at 9 here on AM 1230 WYTS. And have a great week. It's going to be a great day, at least till it rains.